Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa, bringing you the News Gazette. Today, on this Christmas Eve day, December 24th, 2025. Today on the front page, there's a very large picture. It's under the title of Stories of the Season. And in big green letters, it says, "No sleigh for these Santas." And there's a picture here of volunteer firefighters with the Eastern Prairie Fire Protection District. And they showing off donated toys that they'll be delivering on Christmas Eve to children in the neighborhoods that they serve, as well as at Carle Foundation Hospital at Urbana. And it's a great picture, really large, and great picture of our firefighters standing in front of the trucks with loaded down with toys and books. And the article is the title, "Presents to be Delivered by Helicopter. Fire Truck is Part of the 33-Year-Old Tradition," by Luke Taylor from Champaign. Santa's sleigh won't be coming to every Champaign neighborhood this year. He'll be riding a fire truck through some. For the 33rd year in a row, the Eastern Prairie Fire Protection District collected toys and gifts to hand out to kids in the Laurel Woods Edge, Dobbins Down, and Wilbur Heights neighborhood. The volunteer firefighters also will visit kids in Urbana's Carle Foundation Hospital, where Santa will fly in via helicopter. "It's something that takes us away from the emergency services, so they see the other side of things," says District Deputy Chief Jeremy Hoffman. "It's nice to go through the neighborhoods we serve and protect and give presents to kids who really can't get presents." Hoffman is one of the group of firefighters who will be going out to hand deliver all of the gifts starting early on Christmas Eve morning. They'll go through the Woods Edge neighborhood at around 8:30 a.m. before swinging by the hospital and then making rounds through the rest of the district. Caden Hench, another firefighter set to help hand out toys, said the whole tradition is just a great way to give back to the community. "It's something special to be able to see these kids that don't get to experience Christmas like the rest of us and be able to help them and bring a little joy to them during this time of the year," Hench said. "Back in the day, Operation Santa was fully funded by firefighters pooling resources to support residents that they knew would appreciate it." Deputy Chief John Bell said that a little over a decade ago, some wanted to expand the program into something with a wider impact. "Today, all the toys and gifts are donated by folks around the community, collected at the fire station and at Blaine's Farm and Fleet over in Urbana in the weeks leading up to the holiday. Kids are everything, the most innocent people we have on the planet," said firefighter Ryan Lamb. "Unfortunately, some kids don't get the Christmas they deserve, so we do our best to give back to the community in ways of the fire service, so we can step up a little bit and help in other ways more than just being firemen." Santa Claus is Santa Claus, of course, but Bell said the anonymous gentleman portraying him is a good friend with a kind heart, making him a perfect fit to help bring some extra Christmas spirit. He also gets a helicopter ride out of it. On top of celebrating the holiday with giving, firefighter Alexander Ludisher, said that delivering the presents to kids by hand means the volunteer firefighters get a chance to actually connect with the people they want to help. "It's our way for citizens, not only children, but the parents as well, to see some familiar faces in a setting that's not just emergency response," Ludisher said. "You get to have a more wholesome aspect to it, and I think that just kind of brings up the trust level that they have in us. We're there for emergency or non-emergency." And there's an insert in that article with the heading, "Santa's Anonymous Continues to Deliver Gifts and Smiles," from Westville. There's a picture of some large black garbage bags full of things, along with some bikes in a school gym. Gifts collected for Santa's Anonymous in Vermilion County were organized at Wellsville High School before being delivered on Saturday. Some 49 years after Debbie Sarapinas and Cindy Pataki introduced Santa's Anonymous to Vermilion County, the Christmastime tradition is going as strong as ever, thanks to an army of Westville area volunteers. 40 families, including 84 children, received wrapped gifts ahead of Christmas Day. We still have a lot of people who wanted to keep going, Serapina said. Each year, donated items are sorted and wrapped before Santa delivers them to the children's homes. Westville American Legion 51, Post 51 supplies a site to store the items until it's time to take them to Westville High School for the annual toy sort. We always need a little muscle power for the move, and high school football players and other athletes help, Serapina said. This year, there were 15 requests for bicycles, and Serapina said several people pitched in to get them. In addition to toys, Santa's Anonymous also supplies gift cards for the local IGA stores for families in need. And the last article on the front page has the heading, Project Aiming to Break Ground in 2026, the Headstrong Grocery. Former fire station must be torn down first, by Jana Wersima. It's been 7 months since Angela Bradley was awarded a nearly $2.4 million grant from the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity to develop a grocery store in the area of Northwest Urbana that she and local officials have called a food desert. And while ground has yet to be broken on the project site near Lincoln and Bradley Avenues, she's optimistic that construction of Heartstrong Grocery could begin in 2026. The biggest thing right now is working with the state, Bradley said. It's a process to get a grant. It's not an overnight thing by any means. And the state is very careful to make sure that they dot all the I's and cross all the T's. And so it's very important to just be patient and walk with those steps. Bradley's efforts to develop a grocery store in Urbana's Ward 3 was one of four projects to be awarded funds during a recent round of the Illinois New Stores in Food Deserts grant program in May. The city of Urbana has agreed to provide the required one to three local to state match, which will come in at just under $800,000, and also plans to offer city-owned land for the project under a long-term lease at a nominal rate. The site includes the former fire station number 3, which was recently replaced by a new building at Bradley and Goodwin Avenues. Interim Fire Chief Tal Prendergast said in a previous interview that the Urbana Fire Department moved to the new station on December 2nd. Bradley said that the old fire station can be demolished sometime after May of 2026. Our budget has been submitted and a scope of work has been created by our grant manager on the state side for review, she said. And then I guess there's going to be a series of reviews of the grant. And then once all of those levels of approval have been received, then we'll receive the agreement for our signature. And then after that, it goes through another review process for the director's signature. And then the grant will be kind of handed off to the administrative team to set me up for reporting and eventual reimbursement. She added that since she has not signed the agreement yet, there's not yet a deadline attached to the grant. Bradley and her team met with Mayor Deshaun Williams, city staff, and State Representative Carol Ammons, a Democrat from Urbana, on December 15th to discuss the project. Bradley felt that it was a really productive and collaborative discussion. There was so much experience in one room, and everybody brought their gifts to bear and brought their perspectives, she said. The meeting went well, and I left encouraged about the future and continued development of Heartstrong Grocery, Williams told the News Gazette. And there's a picture from left to right here of architect Joseph Alschuler, Urbana City Attorney Matt Rochely, City Planner John Zeman, Mayor Deshaun Williams, Andrea Porter, State Representative Carol Ammons, Angela Bradley, and Joe Bradley. Porter is Ammons' chief of staff. The group met on December 15th to discuss a new grocery store plan for Urbana's Ward 3. There's a special section with the heading Vermilion County First, and under the heading of the Bailey Buzz. There are questions and some answers, so we'll read a few of those. Here's the first question. Did families also get hams for the holidays through the Community Comeback Committee? Danville resident Clyde Butler wants to thank contributors and the community for assistance in giving away turkeys at Thanksgiving and also hams this week for Christmas to families at Carver Park. Butler founded the nonprofit organization in the 1990s. He and the committee have been putting on community events and helping needy families ever since. He said they appreciate the community supporting their endeavors. Another question, when is the DACC scholarship application period? I think I'll skip that one. That's pretty specific. How about this question? Is there a movie premiere coming up for Children of the Cornfield that was shot locally? Oakwood native filmmaker Crystal Hughes is returning for the premiere of her short film, Children of the Cornfield, as she also raises money for the rest of the feature that will be shot here in the spring. The short film, which has won several awards at the La Live Film Festival, will be shown at 7 p.m. Monday at Fisher Theater in downtown Danville. It's a suggestion donation at the door to support the theater. There will also be a raffle and silent auction to help fund the full feature film. Hughes was here in the fall getting those needed cornfield and other scenes. She's excited to show the short. The horror comedy is about the main character, Zella, played by Crystal, and named after her mother, Zella Faye Hughes, and her friend, who they are in journalism society. Something happens and the corn goes away overnight, Hughes said. Everybody will learn in the future what has happened, she said. She has a lot of family and friends helping with her cast. Let's go to an opinion piece in Section A8 by Jim Dye. Trump downgrades marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. Those concerned about steady spread of legalized marijuana across the nation endured a setback last week when President Donald Trump signed an executive order reclassifying the drug. Trump's order, which is subject to legal challenge, changed the drug's Schedule 1 classification to a Schedule 3. In one fell swoop, marijuana status was downgraded from Schedule 1, defined as being of no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse, to Schedule 3, defined as being of some medical benefit as well as moderate to low potential for physical or psychological dependence. The profoundly unhip naturally raised objections to the reclassification. But more importantly, so did the medical researchers who've been trying without success to spread the word of marijuana's negative impact on public mental and physical health. The Wall Street Journal, perplexed by Trump's decision, attributed it to his desire to pursue the stoner vote. Can't afford to buy a home? Don't worry, dude. Puff away your economic anxieties in mom and dad's basement, the WSJ editorialized. Being a teetotaler himself, Trump's move surprised some, but he, like his Democratic predecessors, who also was moving towards reclassification, is not immune to the lavish lobbying campaign waged by the legalization movement to encourage reclassification. Not only do purveyors of legal marijuana want more customers, a distinct possibility in light of this stamp of approval, but they also want the tax benefits the executive order will provide. As the New York Times reported, the most significant consequence of reclassification is the anticipated tax savings for state-licensed businesses that were barred by the Schedule 3 status from taking common deductions for business expenses like rent and payroll. More customers mean more revenue, while new deductions mean lesser taxes paid on that revenue. Hello, big casino. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, the state's leading advocate of marijuana consumption as long as it's bought at state-licensed outlets, must have been doing cartwheels in his office. Of course he can't let that show, because of his antipathy, to all things Trump. But Pritzker has to be drooling over increased marijuana revenues, needing to keep his state's financial house of cards standing. Consumption of marijuana for recreational and health purposes is legal in growing numbers of states, so there's no reason to begrudge anyone their walk down HTC Highway. But it's important for people to know that heavy marijuana consumption, particularly for those who are young and immature or have mental health issues, poses a real health threat. The danger has even spawned a new name for a new diagnosis, marijuana-induced psychosis. Of course, there have been loads of studies already conducted and referenced in news articles about potential dangers. There will most assuredly be more to come. One cause of a variety of symptoms affecting people's mental and physical health is the new higher potency, an estimated 4 to 5 times that of 30 years ago. As studies have shown, the more powerful punch affects brain function. That includes memory, learning, and attention skills. But if anything is as clear as the negative health effects caused by marijuana, it's that few appear to be lending credence to those warnings. Give the marijuana legalization movement credit for casting its foes as hopeless dullards who are haunted by the idea that somewhere, somehow, someone's enjoying himself. But credit review-hungry politicians, those in Illinois who are besotted by the idea of a new revenue source, whatever the social costs. The bottom line, of course, is that customers are on their own. Like those who consume alcohol or cigarettes, they're free to pay their money and make their choices, whether it's well-informed or not. Let's continue on with another opinion piece, of course, with our J. Mark Powell's Holy Cow History. And there is a picture here, black and white, of Montgomery Ward copywriter Bob May and his famous creation at Christmas time, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. The heading is, How a Jewish Man Created a Christmas Classic. You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, and yes, you still recall the most famous reindeer of all, but how did that red-nosed misfit become a star of Yuletide celebrations? He wasn't one of the original 8 tiny reindeer, after all. Who gave him to us? Would you believe it was a Jewish man with a dying wife who had a little daughter and worked for a big company? Robert May, Bob to his family and friends, grew up in the New York area in the early 20th century. When the Great Depression hit, his wealthy Jewish family was ruined. Bob and his wife Evelyn moved to Chicago, where he found work as a copywriter for Montgomery Ward's famous catalogs. The pay was low, but in those days, just having a job was a blessing. Daughter Barbara was soon born, but the May's happiness didn't last long. Evelyn developed cancer in 1937. That diagnosis was a death sentence then. Like any loving spouse, Bob spent every penny he had, and then some, on the best medical treatment as he watched his wife waste away. Bob's boss gave him a special assignment in January of 1939. Montgomery Ward gave kids a free holiday book every Christmas. Though it was popular, the promotion was costly. The boss wanted to save money by producing its own book for the next Christmas shopping season. He told Bob to write it. Oh, and make it an animal story, he added. Bob wondered as he returned to his desk how an animal related to Christmas would work. Piece by piece, answers came to him. He remembered how when they visited Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo, the now 4-year-old Barbara was crazy about the deer. As Evelyn grew sicker, Bob spent hours at her bedside talking with her each night. She told how she'd been painfully shy as a child and how other kids made fun of her and excluded her from their games. That got Bob thinking about his project. As he remembered later, suppose he, the book's main character, were an underdog, a loser, yet triumphant in the end. But what kind of loser? Certainly a reindeer's dream would be to pull Santa's sleigh. Pondering that while staring out his office window one day, nature came to the rescue. Thick fog from Lake Michigan blocked his view. Suddenly I had it. A nose, a bright red nose. A bright red nose that would shine through the fog like a spotlight. He tried different names, Reginald, Rollo, then Rudolph. That was it, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Bob had his story. He excitedly took it to his boss, and the boss hated it. He really, really hated it, saying, "For gosh sakes, Bob, can't you do better than that?" But Bob refused to give up on Rudolph. He asked a friend in the company's art department, "Could you draw a deer with a big red nose and still make him look appealing?" So the next Saturday morning, Bob, little Barbara, and the artist visited the zoo's deer corral. On Monday morning, they took the likeness to the boss. "Bob," he said softly, "forget what I said before and put that story into finished form." Bob began writing it as a poem. As he did, Evelyn died in July. He was understandably devastated. His boss suggested he take time off work and hand over the project to someone else. Bob shook his head. "I needed Rudolph now more than ever. Gratefully, I buried myself in the work." Finally, in late August, it was done. Bob called Barbara and Evelyn's parents into their living room and read the finished poem. "In their eyes, I could see that the story accomplished what I had hoped," he recalled. When the little book was released to Montgomery Ward's customers that Christmas, it was an instant hit. The company distributed 2.5 million copies. By 1946, it had grown to 6 million. That same year, a recording company wanted to produce a spoken word version of the poem. But there was a problem. Montgomery Ward owned the rights to Rudolph's story and image. Some brave soul took the matter directly to Ward's big boss, the notoriously crusty, tough-as-nails Sewell Avery. Yet something touched Avery's heart. Maybe it was sympathy for Bob having lost his wife. Maybe it was appreciation for all the favorable publicity Bob's creation had generated for Ward. Whatever the reason, to everyone's utter astonishment, Avery handed over the rights to Rudolph to Bob, lock, stock, and barrel. A few years later, Bob's brother-in-law wrote the famous song that we learned as children. Bing Crosby, Dinah Shore, and a host of others passed on it. Cowboy singer Gene Autry put it on vinyl just to make his wife stop pestering him about it. Even then, it was the B-side to another holiday song. But Autry changed his tune when Rudolph became number one hit song in America for Christmas in the week in 1949, selling 2.5 million copies that year, countless books, TV special, and even a 2014 U.S. Postal Stamp Service honored Rudolph, too. And just as the other reindeer promised, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer did go down in history, indeed. And another article under our communities about CU Citizen Access by Arnes Caro from Champaign. Legal battle over apartments continues into 2026. A lawsuit filed by the city against an out-of-town owner of run-down apartment buildings remains unsolved heading into 2026. Champaign has been involved in an ongoing legal battle that started in 2022 against the owners of the now-condemned Champaign Park Apartments. The owner of the property, Champaign Apartment Owners LLC, is a company based in New York run by Michael Chetrit. Chetrit is the co-founder of Chetrit Ventures, a family-owned real estate development company. He has owned the apartment since February 2022, county assessment records show. In the span of 2021 to 2023, the city recorded 142 tenant complaints at Champaign Park Apartments, the most of any property in the city during this period. According to the city, the complaints were filed by residents about lack of water, heat, and overall maintenance. In late 2022, some of the apartment buildings were condemned due to poor conditions and overall neglect. Displaced residents were put up in motels, temporary housing, which cost the city more than $250,000. Even after being fully condemned this summer, the complex began to have a squatting problem as there was still electric activity in some of the buildings meant to be vacant. Earlier this year, a fire broke out in one of the three-story buildings. The Champaign Fire Department found the cause was electrical usage in one of the condemned properties. This year, the city received court approval to remove anyone living in the apartments with the condition of giving them 24 hours notice by signage. The electricity in the buildings was completely shut off after approval was given this past July. While the case against this out-of-town owner is ongoing, attention has turned to the Metropolitan Commercial Bank. It is the bank that represents the limited liability company and acts as the service provider for the company. In September, the city requested the defendant, the bank, provide a written statement on whether it has given all the necessary documents and information that was asked for. The four parts of the request included any documentation on repair costs for the buildings, property valuation, ownership changes, and any potential sales agreement. The four parts read as follows. Documents relating to or concerning the repair costs of the buildings or any portion thereof on the property, including, without limitation, contractor estimates. Any and all documents relating to or concerning the valuation of any building located on the property as well as the entire property itself, including but not limited to appraisal reports. Any and all documents pertaining to releases or assignments of interest in the property of any kind in your custody, possession, or control from or by Michael Chetrit or Champagne Apartments Owner, LLC. Any and all purchase and sales agreements in your custody, possession, or control from any party pertaining to the purchase or sale of the property. On August 13th, the Circuit Court ordered a state management order setting the timeline and rules for the proceedings for the plaintiff and defendant with dates running into January of next year. The timeline calls for expert depositions to be completed by January 9th, with a pretrial conference scheduled for January 22nd. And there's a picture of apartments. The frame of the sign for the Champagne Park Apartments along County Fair Drive sits empty with boarded up windows on the condemned apartments buildings in the background. And another article under our communities by Mike Hale, Records and Radio. Pom-poms were part of WKIO's format change plan. December brings all sorts of year-end music calculations and conversations. Since 1981, Billboard has named the Artist of the Year. It combines the Billboard Hot 100 chart, Billboard 200 album chart, and Billboard Box Score, which captures artist touring data. REO Speedwagon was the first recipient of Artist of the Year. 2025's Artist of the Year is Morgan Wallen. Quiz question. Name the two artists who have been named Artist of the Year in at least three different years. Answer at the end of this column. Traditionally, the new year has been a time of opportunity for radio stations to change formats. Many stations introduce new formats in stunting style. End of the year changes have been a rarity in East Central Illinois. But we've had some interesting format introductions. In the summer of 1992, WIXY made its debut, a brand new station on a new frequency, 100.3 in CU. Street talk about the new station was instantaneous. WIXY took a page out of radio playbooks from across the country, and the artist that changed the face of country music, Garth Brooks, WIXY, or otherwise known as Wixie, debuted as Garth 100.3, all Garth, all the time. For the first 10 days of existence, Wixie took the country market by storm, quickly dethroning longtime country leader WIAI 91.1. A side note, Wixie calls letters there were a stroke of genius. They had been sitting for the most part dormant since a Cleveland station dropped them in 1976. WIXY 1260 was a market-leading top 40 station in Cleveland from 1965 until the mid-70s. Unless somebody convinces me differently, WIXY may be the best set of call letters to exist in this area. Making the switch from K104 to oldies for WKIO initially was a tough discussion. Quite simply, the more 50s, 60s, and 70s music, and less 80s music. K104 played each hour, rating increases followed. Plus, in market after market across the country, stations were making the switch to oldies. If WKIO didn't make the switch, could one new Sign on frequencies 105.9 or 103.3, grab the franchise. We open the checkbook and turn to the country's leading radio researcher, Bill Moyes, and his team for answers. After a thorough perceptual study of hundreds of listeners in Champaign County, it was an easy call for us to make the switch to oldies. We decided to let the Assembly Hall make our format change announcement. One of key Illini promoters, K104, did during the Mike White, Lou Henson, and John Makovich eras was turning Memorial Stadium and the Assembly Hall orange with K104 pom-poms. We ordered 16,000 plus in announcing the format change. Those pom-poms would be placed on all the seats by our staff on February 4th of 1990 ahead of the Illini-Indiana basketball game that day. And I'm going to have to stop and take a break here with our News Gazette. I'll be back in a moment.